In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies. It is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Everytown Podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. We give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Everytown Podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive.
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator.
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack,
dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you. Now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Plinky County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
Welcome to episode 3 of Conspiracy Unlimited. On this installment, the murder of John Lennon. It was 37 years ago today. The narrative of the crazed lone gunman from Oswald to James Earl Ray to Sirhan Sirhan seems to be a common denominator in many high-profile assassinations. The official narrative certainly portrays Lennon's killer in much the same fashion. A disgruntled fan looking to gain some notoriety. But could Lennon have been targeted for assassination, just as he was set to reemerge from his self-imposed exile and resume his political activism? Could his killer, Mark David Chapman, have been a programmed assassin, a Manchurian candidate? My guest, author John Potash, thinks it's highly likely.
Castle Memorial was a known CIA conduit for behavior modification for patsies and for training and developing assassins for the CIA. And that's the hospital in Hawaii where Mark David Chapman was a patient at one point. And after coming out, after being a patient in their mental health, mental ward, he ends up getting a job there soon after. And then, just getting a job as a security guard, I believe it was, Yeah, or first a janitor, then a security guard, I believe. And then he ends up having loads of money to travel around the world, staying in top hotels.
This podcast is brought to you by Logo Creator 7 Software. These days, it's more important than ever to have a good image, especially if you have a small business or you sell stuff online or post on social media. But quality graphics can cost money, and advanced software like Photoshop takes time to learn. That's why I want to tell you about some amazing piece of software called Creator 7. Creator 7 is so easy to use, yet it lets you create super-looking logos, business cards, character mascots, you name it, in minutes. Whatever you create is going to look super cool and impressive. Creator 7 comes with hundreds of ready-made templates. Just click and drag to make changes, and instantly you have really impressive graphics right on your computer. Some clever folks have even ordered the Creator 7 software to start their own logo-making business, creating and selling logos and graphics for a profit. That's how good it is. But you won't believe the price. Creator 7 creates beautiful logos and designs right on your computer and works on either PC or Mac. And right now, it's available at an amazing price. To see it in action, just visit radioshowlogo.com. That's radioshowlogo.com. radioshowlogo.com.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serres. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
I've told this story a number of times on my weekly radio show, The Conspiracy Show, and on Coast to Coast. But if you're just discovering me through this podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited, you haven't heard it. But back on December the 8th, 1980, I was almost 17, and I had just discovered the Beatles. 1 year earlier, in fact, on a high school class trip to Toronto, I ventured into the legendary record shop, Sam the Record Man, on Yonge Street, and purchased the Capitol Records Beatles Anthology, 1967 to 1970. It was a double album. And I brought it home and proceeded to wear it out over the next year. But back to that night, December 8th, I was at my friend Tom's place just around the corner. And like a lot of people, we had Monday Night Football on the TV. But we had the sound turned down because we were playing that Beatles album on full volume. And there we were, singing along to Strawberry Fields and Fool on the Hill. And so we missed Howard Cosell announced that Lennon had just been shot in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, where he died on arrival. And I remember we shut the TV off, and I was on my way home. I remember whistling a Beatles song in that crisp night air, walking on air, thinking that Lennon was about to release a new album and perhaps the Beatles might reunite after all. I was so excited. A lot of my friends were. And then when I got home, of course, my sister told me the news that Lennon had been killed. It was a punch to the midsection, and I was left doubled over, grimacing like Oswald during that prison transfer. I don't think I ever recovered, even though I'm now over 50. Of course, Chapman made a widow out of Yoko, and his young son Sean lost a father. I was just a fan, but I felt ripped off. I think most Beatles fans felt as though we had been robbed of something. It was a cruel theft. For many of us, that sting still lingers. And so we are going to reopen the case and re-examine the murder of John Lennon. In particular, we'll look at whether Mark David Chapman might have been programmed to kill John Lennon. John Potash has been featured on C-SPAN's American History TV. He's been interviewed on dozens of radio stations around the U.S. and abroad. His work has also been published in the Baltimore Chronicle, the City Paper, Covert Action Quarterly, Rock Creek Free Press, and Z Magazine. He's worked counseling people with mental health issues and addictions for over 25 years. In May 2015, John released his book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA's murderous targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lennon, Cobain, Tupac, and other activists. John Potash, how are you?
I'm good, Rich. Good to be talking to you again.
Likewise. Here we are, the 37th anniversary of the murder assassination of former Beatle John Lennon. And just recently we learned that Mark David Chapman will be up for parole in August of 2018. If you were a betting man, does he get out this time?
Don't know. I would say no, but I can't be sure.
I know that Yoko Ono has been there almost each and every parole hearing. Why do you suppose, I mean, if this was any other individual, any other murder case, I mean, it's been, as I say, 37 years.
Yeah.
The odds are likely they'd be out on the street. The reports are he's been a model citizen in prison.
Okay.
Why are they keeping him behind bars, do you think, John?
Well, they can say public sentiment, which is there, of course, you know, because John Lennon was beloved by so many around the millions and millions around the world. But I think it's for political reasons, in the sense that they don't want Mark David Chapman to be known better, meaning they don't know what they don't want people to know what he's really about. They don't want him to reveal anything of his history, which is interlocked with the histories of police, and what I believe are police intelligence agents. And he was groomed, whether he fully knew it or not, he was being groomed and, you know, hypnotized by police intelligence, or U.S. intelligence, I should say, but particular police officers were handling it for U.S. intelligence. And so that's what I don't think, you know, why I think they don't want the public to know more about him.
So you believe that Mark David Chapman was a Manchurian candidate?
Yes. I tend not to use that term, but I know in other countries it's easier to use that term and be believed. I think in the United States it's harder to use that term and be kind of accepted with as much credibility, because the press here is just more controlled, I think, than other countries. And so I would just say that CIA documents that, you know, have gotten, you know, seen, have been released, show that their hypnosis techniques and their use of hypnotic, you know, psychohypnotic drugs have gotten them to the point that they are able to turn people into assassins without their knowledge, you know, under hypnotic suggestion. And, you know, the documents talk about their success, and so that's what I believe Mark David Chapman was, yes, in the end. Whether he was the actual, you know, assassin, or whether Jose Perdomo, who was also at the scene, who was the doorman at the scene, you know, who also is believed to have fired shots, either, you know, whichever one of them did it, it was U.S. intelligence orchestrated, because Jose Perdomo, and his full name is longer than that, is known to have been a Cuban exile who was working for the CIA for decades, you know, going back to, you know, the Bay of Pigs invasion, and then, you know, with Watergate. He was involved heavily with a number of CIA operations, and there he is, you know, at the shooting of John Lennon.
Yeah, an interesting last-minute replacement for the regular doorman.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been confirmed 100%? I mean, or at least to your satisfaction, that it was the same Jose Perdomo on the door at the Dakota that night, who, as you said, participated in the Bay of Pigs invasion, was a CIA operative. Well, is there any question at that point? At this point,
I don't believe so. I mean, I think Philip Strongman did the best work on that in terms of with his book. He's a very well known music writer in England, and produced a number of music books that were highly acclaimed. And then he wrote the book about, you know, John Lennon, and he used the full name, four different, you know, the two middle names, and says it's the exact name of the man they have in the Cuban archives as one of the people that was working to, you know, try to assassinate, of course, Fidel Castro, and part of the CIA squad with the Bay of Pigs invasion. And there's just too much evidence that it is the same Jose Perdomo.
What can you tell me about the forensics or the ballistics after the shooting? What do we know? I believe it was reported that Chapman, the alleged gunman, used hollow point bullets, which are just, you know, devastating, which begs another question. How would someone get a hold of hollow point bullets? But just leaving that aside for a moment, how many shots fired? Talk to me about, if you can, the trajectory, any inconsistencies in the ballistics or forensics.
Yeah, my understanding is that there was many more bullets than, you know, than Chapman had in his gun. And so, you know, there was obviously had to be two people shooting with the number of bullets versus the number, you know, with the one gun holding a certain amount of bullets. And so, you know, I'm sorry, I don't remember all the exact number of bullets because I analyzed a number of different political assassinations in my second book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. And so, but, you know, it's just there's many more bullets than there were, you know, supposed to be in one chamber, in Mark David Chapman's gun. Plus the fact that the trajectory was incredible in terms of the tightness of the shot in a circle, like so tight they could, you know, apparently the coroner couldn't tell one bullet wound from another because it was such an incredible sharpshooter type job that was done in the assassination of John Lennon. So there's just a number of elements of it that suggest that even though Dana Reeves, the police officer who trained Mark David Chapman in to become a sharpshooter, you know, did a pretty good job in that he scored, say, 88 out of 100 when he applied to be a security guard, and all you needed to be was 60 out of 100, you know, you get a score of 60 out of 100 to pass the test. Still, it was a highly trained sharpshooter that really did the job, and so it suggests that it was really Jose Perdomo that carried out the assassination of John Lennon. So, you know, I think that that's just some of the elements that show that this was, of course, a U.S. intelligence orchestrated political assassination.
The parallels to the RFK assassination are quite striking, as you say. More bullets fired than were in the chamber of the supposed murder weapon. That harkens back to Sirhan Sirhan's.
Right.
What was that, a five-shooter he had, that Ivor Johnson, what was it, something like that? And then, you know, he claims that all he remembers was being served a giant urn of coffee, whether it was Rohypnol or whatever was in there. It's like we've seen this movie before, John.
Right, yeah. I mean, a Columbia University professor who's one of the top experts in hypnosis said that Sirhan fell in that 10% of the population that was highly hypnotizable, Sirhan. And so my guess is that Mark David Chapman was similar to that. He just fell in that 10% of the population that could be hypnotized. And William Jennings Bryan actually said, I have him on tape, saying that, you know, with enough time and drugs, he could hypnotize someone to do anything he wanted in terms, including assassination. And he had, you know, allegedly bragged to two prostitutes that regularly serviced him that he had, you know, hypnotized Sirhan to carry out the assassination of RFK. Now, the amount of people shot, I don't know if you heard about a kind of Hollywood movie that came out a few years back, about 5-10 years ago, where they just had recreations of the lives of all the people shot in that RFK incident, and it was many. We're talking about, you know, 5 or 6 different people were shot. There were so many bullets going off that now it was known. One reporter said on film that I have that there was no way Sirhan got closer than 2 feet to RFK. Well, he saw a security guard take out his gun and fire within inches of RFK. And so the coroner, knowing Thomas Noguchi, knowing what was going on with that shooting, how important it was, especially after, you know, JFK's assassination, called in the top experts from around the country to do that autopsy with him. And they found that the shots came from within about 1 inch of RFK's ear, from behind his ear. And
right,
that's where
right.
The shots that killed him. So, you know, yes, Mark David Chapman's, assassination via hypnosis of John Lennon was duplicated earlier in an even bigger operation against RFK. And I've, talked to people that studied under a Harvard Harvard expert in hypnosis too, who said he tells his classes regularly that yes, Sirhan, was most likely by all evidence from him analyzing Sirhan for 500 hours. He was called in by Sirhan's lawyer to analyze him for 500 hours, and he found that yes, he believes that he was hypnotized to be the patsy in carrying out, the actions he did in shooting at RFK that night.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. We haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
I just spoke with Hollywood director Paul Davids a couple of nights ago. He has a new book out called Blowing America's Mind about his involvement in the LSD experiments at Princeton University in the late 1960s, before Princeton went co-ed. A lot of people don't know Princeton was a male-only university. And he and the co-author, John Selby, got caught up in these LSD experiments. Of course, they were promised, well, this will be wonderful. You'll trip and, it'll enhance your sexual prowess and you'll have spiritual enlightenment and so forth. And meanwhile, they were hypnotizing them, deep hypnotic, sessions coupled with microdosing of LSD. Now that's late '60s. That's 10, 11, 12 years before the Lennon assassination.
But that's important. I'm glad you brought that up. That's an important part of all this story, I believe. MKUltra, that was part of Project MKUltra, and Project MKUltra started in 1953. It had under it 149 sub-projects. Now, one of those sub-projects was a massive funding of a front company called the Human Ecology Fund out of Cornell Medical School. They gave money and grants out to over 100 colleges around the United States, as well as hundreds of prisons and mental hospitals, to do psychedelic experiments on paying people to take LSD and to take psychedelic mushrooms. Now, why did they do that? I show the evidence that they did that for the purpose of spreading these psychedelics to hurt the minds of the budding civil rights movement, the massive civil rights movement in 1962 and 1963, but also to hurt the minds of budding anti-war protesters that, because the Vietnam War was already starting, was already getting off the ground, and there was already some people were organizing to say, what's going on over there in Vietnam? And some of these people were also the civil rights activists. And so, and they were very successful in getting this popularized, LSD popularized. And some of the ways they did it is these experiments all over the place, plus what I call AstroTurf campaigns. That's a PR term for fake grassroots. So they had these fake grassroots campaigns to popularize acid in the supposed underground scene. And one of the supposed underground scenes was at Timothy Leary's Millbrook Mansion. He was a Harvard professor who had gotten those grants from the Human Ecology Fund. And he was actually just doing it with mushrooms at the time. But then a British agent named Michael Hollingshead came in and got him tripping for three straight days on acid. And so he agreed. He was, his fellow professors who were working with him on these psychedelic studies said his mind seemed to turn into jelly at that point, and he became like a lapdog for Hollingshead. But he started using acid in his experiments also at that point. And Leary ended up saying that he knew he was a witting agent of the CIA, and 80% of his actions were CIA-based. And he told, I believe it was Paul Krasner, that in an interview. And so he starts the Millbrook Mansion. He gets kicked out of Harvard. The Mellon Hitchcock family, who owned Gulf Oil and Mellon Bank, etc., they give him huge amounts of money to start the psychedelic studies group. They give him their mansion. Billy Mellon Hitchcock gives him his mansion, and a number of MK Ultra scientists just house themselves at that mansion. And they get all kinds of cultural figures and different other people to come up to that mansion from New York City, because it was an hour north of New York City, and they use them as guinea pigs. He's just giving them all different kinds of psychedelics, and they spread psychedelics as this supposedly underground phenomenon, when here's the CIA scientists, helping, just experimenting on people and trying to get them to spread the notion that this is a wild new thing to do. And the same thing happened in San Francisco with the acid test and Ken Kesey.
Yes.
Ken Kesey went through those experiments. All of a sudden, he's got access to unlimited amounts of acid from the place that, once he did the experiment, the hospital, he started working at the hospital, giving keys to the acid, the supplies, and then he's bringing it home and having all these parties with acid, even though before he did these experiments with acid, he had barely even gotten drunk in his life because he was a college wrestler. And very serious about his being in shape and things like that. So here he is all of a sudden turning tons of people into acid, and then he starts the acid test with this group that is seems to have a high number of military officers involved in it, ex-military officers.
Guys, even from even being popularized, excuse me, John, but even being popularized by the from a button-down individual like Tom Wolfe.
Right.
And so it becomes almost acceptable in sort of the high literary circles. It's, what's interesting is that there, the origins of the Grateful Dead, and how they were sort of used. So, Tavistock, CIA, MI6, whoever, using these musical artists to help make psychedelics acceptable, desirable, on the one hand, and then using those same psychedelics, perhaps, whether it was done in the case of Mark David Chapman, to take out those same artists. I mean, the irony is incredible.
Right. Yeah. Well, the reason is, of course, and you pointed that out really well in your film of talking to Marshall McLuhan's assistant, is the fact that they just, some of these, well, the British artists in particular, were not realizing what was going on in the way they're manipulated. And that's John Lennon, and, for example, in the Rolling Stones, like Mick Jagger, they were against the war. They were against the Vietnam War. They were pro-civil rights. John Lennon refused to play in clubs in the United States when they first toured the United States. He wouldn't play in clubs that were segregated in the South. And so these people were relatively political, but they didn't realize how much they were getting manipulated. And so, for example, in 1965, the assistant to director of MKUltra, Robert Lashbrook, came over to England, according to Ernest Hemingway's editor, A.E. Hotchner. He wrote a great book called Blown Away about the Rolling Stones. But in that book, he included the fact that Lashbrook brings over to England in 1965 massive amounts of acid, tons of money, and agents, tries to get acid in as many musicians' hands as possible. And so that same year, this dentist of George Harrison has George Harrison and, you know, John Lennon and their partners over for dinner and proceeds to dose their coffee with LSD at a time when George Harrison had never even heard of LSD. And John Lennon was furious when he found out that they were dosed. And so this is an example of how this guy does this, assaults their minds with thinking he's completely immune from getting sued or anything else, because people who realize, think they're that immune from the law or lawsuits usually have that kind of power because they're working for British or U.S. intelligence. And so, and this is, of course, the same year as Lashbrook, you know, had this plan and was carrying out this plan. And Mick Jagger also kind of held out from using acid until 1967. In 1967, someone finally, a guy named Dave Schneiderman, gets him to try acid for the first time. And David Schneiderman's outed in the Daily Mail as having worked for MI5 and the American FBI. And so now the FBI and, of course, MI5 and MI6 were all working together in collaboration in these kinds of operations under, you know, the rubric of MKUltra and the Tavistock Institute.
Right, right.
And I argue, and the reason they did this, of course, was to popularize acid amongst the masses to hurt our minds and not, you know, have us be as effective at our anti-war work.
Particularly, and right after the Kennedy assassination, along come the Beatles, sort of a wonderful sell for the American youth culture, just getting over the devastation of the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. Never mind the Warren Report over here. Here, trip out on this. So in many respects, the British invasion was just that. It was a British invasion.
Yeah, and so, and Jim Garrison was doing great research on the, you know, JFK assassination at that time, and coming out, you know, on TV, national television, like the Johnny Carson, saying, there's no doubt after serious investigation of all this, no doubt in my mind that the CIA played a part in the assassination of our president and president, you know, and, you know, Lyndon Johnson's concealing this fact. And so, yeah, it was a huge diversion from the massive, you know, uproar over what was going, you know, what really happened to to JFK's, you know, in the assassination.
Now, and the wrapping up of, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go, Rich. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and the ramping up after Kennedy's assassination, his memorandum de-escalating U.S. involvement in Vietnam is reversed. And so about the time the Beatles land, Johnson is re-upping U.S. involvement in Vietnam. So again, very timely for the Beatles to land. I wanted to ask you whether you think that when Lennon came to Toronto in 1969, I mean, as far as he was concerned, the Beatles were finished, the Plastic Ono Band was performing here, and he met with our great communications guru, Marshall McLuhan. And the according to legend, McLuhan basically told John Lennon, "You are a useful fool." I don't know if he used terms like, you know, if he said things like the Tavistock Institute, but Lennon apparently stormed out, thought about it, came back and said, "You know, Marshall, I think you're right." And I don't know how much of that meeting do you think may have. I mean, it certainly changed. It seemed to have changed the trajectory of Lennon's creativity in terms of becoming more political.
Yeah, I think now you turn me on to that, you know, that happenstance. I just document the fact that Lennon did get so much more political around that time of 1969, and it's, you know, it's fascinating that McLuhan did change his mind. But yeah, he just, I think it was a major spark. I mean, Lennon already had it in him. It was just a matter of McLuhan just helping him realize what was going, you know, what was going on, and turning, you know, turning the faucets on for him to get much more politically active, because he was already says, I mean, he had said in 66 that he was, you know, they talked about the war all the time, and they were all the Beatles were against it. But really turning, you know, getting much more active in 69 was very important, and seemed like McLuhan was a huge spark for that. And so Lennon started, you know, different anti-war actions, and started, he hosted, I think he had a TV program, I don't know if it was, you know, which one, but it was one of the top TV, you know, talk shows in the United States. He was the host for a week and brought on Black Panthers and anti-war protesters and all kinds of radical celebrities on that show when he hosted it for a week.
That might have been the Mike Douglas show,
thinking. Yeah, I think it was, sure. And so he also funded the protests against the Republican National Convention in 1972. He funded the Realist, Paul Krasner's you know, magazine that Mae Brussels was being printing a lot of great articles in, and she was a great leftist researcher, anti-war researcher, and JFK researcher and all. And so he was doing, he just really turned it on in terms of the political protests. So, of course, they came down on him much heavier at that time, too. And so they were threatening to deport him. He was in a constant legal battle over that. And so he came out with his most political albums, of course, you know, his most political songs with his solo albums in the early 70s. But he was still also fighting the effects of acid. He said, you know, I found different things, quotes of his, that he said he threw up for an hour or two before performing because he was so anxious about performing by himself, when he never had that kind of anxiety, you know, or at least he didn't have anywhere near as much anxiety when he was performing, you know, earlier in his career. And acid, that's one of the symptoms of acid. When you do a lot of acid, it causes more and more anxiety and inability to control that anxiety, and so he was, you know, fighting that also. So he finally goes, he ends up, you know, just going into recluse and just raising his child for a few years. But when he comes out of that, and comes out with two albums, and comes out with the fact that he's going to play music and lead a march of Teamster, I think it was port workers in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Right, the day after the assassination, he was scheduled to fly out, and his reemergence into political activism.
Yeah, and so they knew what he was going to do, and they also knew how popular he still was and would be with the two new albums, and how much he would be a threat to the Reagan administration's right-wing policies.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I am a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
John Potash is with us. And John, you are a world-class researcher. If you're looking for world-class website hosting at a fair price, there's a company I want to tell you about, Pear Networks. Pear Networks. They host hundreds of thousands of websites. And why do I recommend them? Well, simply because they set the standard for excellence. With a technical support staff that's second to none, their support team responds so quickly. You wouldn't believe it. And they always give straight answers, which I appreciate because, quite frankly, I'm kind of slow. And that's important. Plus, they have top-of-the-line technology. That's why Pear Networks offers total reliability for your website. And it comes with a money-back guarantee. So whether you're a professional web designer, a busy web marketer, or you're just getting a site online, Pear Networks has a web hosting plan that's right for you. Log on and learn more at pear.com. Let me spell it out for you. P-A-I-R.com. P-A-I-R.com. Pear Networks.
As you're staring up at the night sky, ever wonder who's staring back? No, me either. But I guess you better say it because of Richard, you know, he's all wrapped up in this stuff. Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
We are back with John Potash, who is the author of Drugs as Weapons Against Us. We're talking about the assassination, murder of John Lennon 37 years ago. Mark David Chapman up for parole in August of 2018. And I think both John and I are on the same page. It's highly unlikely he will ever see the light of day because he knows too much. I want to ask you about the apparent mental deterioration of Chapman in the months leading up to Lennon's assassination, back and forth between his home in Hawaii. He traveled to Georgia several times. He had family friends there. I believe in Duluth. He was serving as a YMCA camp counselor. There was a lot of, you know, to New York. He was shadowing Lennon for a while. Then, I think he was intent on actually committing, the deed earlier, then backed out. And all the while, what we're hearing is that his mental condition just, as if he was descending into madness, hearing voices. Now, is that just sort of the official narrative, or do you think that was perhaps part of the fracturing of his psyche, a la MKUltra?
Yeah, I think it was probably related more to the fracturing of his psyche with MKUltra, because the same things were happening with Sirhan Sirhan. He was doing a lot of repetitive writing, and that's what Chapman was found to be doing. And so I think the hypnosis and the drugs were causing some of the same symptoms in both of them before their, you know, assassinations of our beloved leaders, you know, RFK and John Lennon. And so I think that's what was going on. But a more interesting aspect of all this traveling is the fact that he even went around the world twice in the few years before he killed John Lennon, and he just didn't have the funds to do that. And Castle Memorial Hospital gave him the money to do that, and Professor Peter Dale Scott, a great researcher here, he's a professor at University of California, he was a professor at University of California, Berkeley, he's retired now, but He said that Castle Memorial was a known CIA conduit for behavior modification for patsies and, you know, and for kind of training and developing assassins for the CIA. And that's, you know, that's the hospital in Hawaii where Mark David Chapman was a patient at one point. And after coming out, after being a patient in their mental health, you know, mental ward, he ends up getting a job there soon after. And then, you know, just getting a job as a security guard, I believe it was. Yeah, or first a janitor, then a security guard, I believe. And then he ends up having loads of money to travel around the world, staying in top hotels. And as you said, traveling back and forth between Hawaii and Georgia, where his family was, and, you know, and staying with this police officer, Philip Strongman, identified him as Dana Reeves. But Fenton Bressler, the attorney who was a legal correspondent, just used a pseudonym, Gene, for him. But he's staying with him. He's being, you know, he appears to be his handler because he's the one that turned Chapman from a person who hated guns, according to Chapman's parents, to someone who, you know, is using guns and becoming a, you know, a good shooter. And then he also, of course, Dana Reeves gives him the hollow point bullets with which he killed, you know, shot John Lennon. He killed John Lennon. So this is just some of the, you know, massive evidence that a number of researchers have gathered on the fact that between Chapman and Perdomo, U.S. intelligence, of course, appeared to orchestrate John Lennon's assassination.
Whatever happened to Dana Reeves, do we know?
No, there was no investigation of him except by these independent, you know, researchers. So nothing, we don't know what, you know, became of him. But obviously police didn't, you know, question him to any serious degree. So I don't know where he went after that.
Also reports that that Chapman, again, I mentioned the YMCA connection. He was a YMCA counselor, that he was taken to Lebanon. This was during the Lebanese Civil War, mid-70s, 75, 76, as part of ostensibly as part of a sort of a YMCA counseling school, I guess, but was taken to either U.S. intelligence or British intelligence training camp in Lebanon, where perhaps he was trained. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, researchers say that they need to take him to a war-torn area to what they call bloody him, to get him used to firing, you know, weapons, shots, murder, to help condition him so that under hypnosis he's more used to shooting guns or having guns shot and the sound of it and murdering, you know, to be able to carry out the murder. And so, you know, and after that, I believe he was stationed at a South Vietnamese refugee camp, and, you know, went under further conditioning there. And so, and South Vietnamese were the ones, the refugees from South Vietnam, a number of them were ones that were working for American forces, you know, or at least the American puppet president of South Vietnam when they were at war with North Vietnam. And so a number of them were assassins, you know, as part of the Phoenix program and all that, and that were just assassinating North Vietnamese and North Vietnamese sympathizers all over South Vietnam. So, and then another actually interesting thing about that, and this may sound like a crazy tangent, but one of the people suspected to be involved in Kurt Cobain's murder was taken, you know, believe it or not, Courtney Love, mm-hmm, came and hung out at a refugee camp in, I guess it was in England, when she was in her late teens. And she was taken there by a CIA agent, according to her father, and this man's named Steve O'Leary. And I've checked out his sources about when he died, and and he said he got a letter from him admitting on his deathbed that he was working for the CIA at the time when he was traveling with Courtney Love for 6 weeks or more. And she proceeded to distribute acid. She brought 1,000 hits of acid to the London music scene when she was 17 years old and distributed acid and other drugs like candy at that scene and then in a number of music scenes throughout the United States. And that, you know, of course, paralleled the MKUltra operations of a number of agents, like I mentioned last week before, but there was a number of agents that did that kind of work, just taking tons of acid to different music scenes and spreading them around. And so it's interesting that the John Lennon of his generation, Kurt Cobain, the person who was believed to be involved in his murder, and it was at a refugee camp for a while, war refugee camp for a while, similar to Chapman being there also.
Right.
But it's believed that he was further, went through more behavioral modification there too. Yeah.
John Potash is with me, the author of Drugs as Weapons Against Us. We're talking about the assassination of John Lennon 37 years ago. You mentioned Fenton Bresler, and I think he wrote, one of the definitive works on this whole assassination. He interviewed, I believe it was the chief investigator from NYPD, the homicide detective on this, and Bresler talked about how odd it was that after doing the deed, Chapman simply sat down on the curb and calmly thumbed through his copy of Catcher in the Rye and waited to be arrested, which again, has all the markings of a Manchurian candidate. I know you don't like that term, but for shorthand, we'll use it. And my recollection in that book was the NYPD detective didn't dispute that possibility.
Yeah, so Bresler quoted that NYPD detective, and that detective was the head of an area that had a million people. It was a very large area of New York City. So he presided over an area of many, many detectives who were, being in charge of an area of a million people. And so this guy said, after examining Chapman, he said, I know what you're going to make of this, but he appeared programmed. That's just the best way I can put it. That's the way he appeared. He appeared like he was programmed. And so this is a high-level, police commanding officer saying this. And so, the higher ups of the NYPD do get privy to some of these things, operations that go on, maybe directly or maybe just indirectly. But indirectly, he knew that people could be programmed, I believe. And that's the way he described Chapman to Fenton Bresler.
That's actually startling, admission. One of the other common threads through all of these political assassinations is there is either no trial because the suspect is gunned down, Oswald, or they plead guilty, as in Chapman, as in James Earl Ray, as in Sirhan Sirhan. There's never a trial. What happened, do you suppose, between the time Chapman was taken to Bellevue Hospital that night for evaluation and his arraignment? As far as I recall, there was no indication that he was going to suddenly plead guilty. It seems to me it was a sudden about-face. This thing was supposed to go to trial.
Mm-hmm. Well, not to take you on too much of a tangent yet again, but Martin Luther King's, the top researcher on Martin Luther King's assassination, William Pepper, said that with James Earl Ray, accepted assassin of Martin Luther King, he says that James Earl Ray was just given an attorney and pushed. The attorney was pushed on him, and he was kind of pressured into accepting a certain, saying, I'll accept a plea, and to quiet him and just send him off into prison without much fanfare or any investigation or any trial. And obviously with Chapman, it was very easy to do that with his already being hypnotized. And so they just wanted to not have much evidence come out in court hearings of any kind to expose what was really going on with him.
Seems to me also there was an article in Time magazine, and Chapman talked about undergoing a spontaneous exorcism while he was in his jail cell. These demons came out of him. Is that consistent in terms of programming MKUltra?
I haven't heard about that, so I just don't know. I don't know. I haven't heard of that kind of symptom. I just don't know much about other symptoms besides some of those things I mentioned. So I just don't know about that kind of sometimes. I didn't read that article, and I haven't heard of that before.
We mentioned the Manchurian Candidate book in his hip pocket, which has been kind of – that's become kind of a almost shorthand, you know, for mind control. It was featured in Mel Gibson's movie, Conspiracy Theory. I believe it was called Conspiracy Theory, that came out, must be close to 20 years ago. What do you suppose is the connection with that book, Catcher in the Rye? Is it used as a trigger?
Yeah, I heard in your film, I heard one of your witnesses talk about that was a common trigger, and it was apparently used by Tavistock Institute and British, intelligence were using that as a trigger. I don't know much about that either in terms of that being used as a trigger, but it's interesting because the researcher you interviewed in that film that stated that, I agree with him. What he was suggesting was that the British are kind of ahead of the United States in that regard in terms of kind of some of these hypnosis techniques and mind control techniques, and that I definitely agree with and can believe, because the British intelligence is so much older than American intelligence. Of course, American intelligence has a lot more money and a much more brainwashed population in the United States because of more control over the media and more use of our tax dollars for that versus healthcare and things that you take for granted in Canada and in Britain. But I don't know that much about that book being a constant trigger, being used often.
Why allow, if I'm MI6 or CIA and I orchestrated Lenin's assassination, why would I allow Chapman to live? Why not just tie up that loose end the way that they did with Oswald? Why allow Chapman to live all these years? And who knows? I mean, he does have access to the media. He could say something that that could incriminate his handlers.
Yeah, I can't say I know why they allowed him to live. I imagine if he did start to be perceived as a threat and did voice some opinions about that he was brainwashed, that he was hypnotized or anything, he wouldn't be living longer. But I think that they did a good job of controlling him, such a good job that they don't perceive him as a threat that way. Now they may perceive that keeping him alive is almost a subconscious warning to other political musicians. That's possible.
Interesting.
That could be part of what it is, because I do believe they do that. They do use lots of subconscious threats, whether it be having him come up in the news every now and then with around parole or something, or anniversary timing tactics with the way they kill people. That's another subconscious technique they use to warn activists about not doing certain things. So that's a possibility.
I guess final point, and that is the other Beatles, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr. Certainly McCartney continues. I mean, this guy can sell out a football stadium in seconds anywhere in the world. He continues to capture the minds and the hearts of young people, even at age 75. Do you think that he got the message somehow? I mean, he's never been overly political. He picks his, he's certainly into, eating a vegan diet and so forth, but never been overtly political. Do you think he got the message and he understands what happened to John Lennon?
I would guess so, because after George Harrison's bizarre murder also, I think he probably is careful about what he says and does. When two of your fellow bandmates are murdered, and he suspects something around that, I would imagine he got the message.
Can't leave that hanging. I can't leave that hanging. We could turn it into another show, but maybe we will touch on Harrison another time. But very quickly, so the brain cancer, which metastasized, I guess, from the lung cancer, Was that given to him during that that break-in where he was attacked by an intruder years earlier?
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but it was just such a bizarre attack of someone breaking his house and stabbing him. You know, Bob Marley was given a boots with a metal, you know, sharp metal object inside of them by a CIA agent. And according to witnesses, you know, at the time they didn't know this guy. This, in, you know, new person in their film crew was an agent, but they found out later. And that toe that got jabbed by that kind of pin inside the shoe, inside the gift boots, ended up having cancer. You know, that toe developed cancer within a few months. And MKUltra documents say how they were working on the fastest inducing cancer possible, and they were having success. And so Marley gets cancer in that same toe, and it spreads throughout his body, and that's what he dies of. So, you know, it's not unprecedented.
All right, Jonathan, a great pleasure. Thank you again. How can people get a copy of Drugs as Weapons Against Us?
Yeah, they can. You know, it's available on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble, you know, including a number of shelves, Barnes & Noble shelves around the country. And or you can get it directly from me at drugsasweapons.com, www.drugsasweapons.com.
And what are you working on these? My pleasure. What are you working on these days, John?
Well, I'm just finalizing a film with a law firm that's just making sure everything's documented right for a film based on Drugs as Weapons Against Us. And I do a film on my first book, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, but this film is much better. And then now that that's just about finalized, kind of turning Drugs as Weapons into a kind of a political novel that's going to try to make it, believe it or not, entertaining.
Wonderful. It's entertaining. It's grim, but it is entertaining, to say the least. John, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Rich.
Well, it's just about time for me to wander upstairs and climb into the old Schlafensack. But before I turn off the lights here under the stairs, I want to fill you in on what's coming up next on Episode 4 of Conspiracy Unlimited. But before I do that, let me ask you, have you heard about this free guide you can download? It contains a list of online power tools to make you more efficient, secure, even boost your income. And best of all, this online toolbox guide is absolutely free. How do you get it? It's simple. Visit freebusinesstoolbox.com and grab your copy while they last. This guide has some of the very same online tools that successful business owners use every day, and each one is highly recommended. Yeah, I know. Some websites will offer some special giveaway like this, but then they stick you into a recurring program or some other deal. This isn't like that. There's no hidden thing to try, no credit card needed, no cost whatsoever. BrightBiz is literally giving away this online toolbox guide completely free. It's sort of a putting their best foot forward type of thing. But this is a limited time offer, so grab your free guide today and take your business and your income to the next level. Visit freebusinesstoolbox.com to get your free guide to 36 online power tools. That address again, freebusinesstoolbox.com. Coming up on Episode 4 of Conspiracy Unlimited, two well-known Princeton alumni at last reveal the true inside story of how they got caught up in and nearly done in by the CIA's LSD-laced deep hypnosis research while they were Princeton students in the late 1960s. My guest is Paul Jeffrey Davids, co-author of Blowing America's Mind, a true story of Princeton, CIA mind control, LSD, and Zen. Until next time, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.